concrete, wood, fiber, and more. Wind, Water, and Light, far from the ordinary, at 10 Main Street in downtown Champaign.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. What certainly seems that every day, the world in which we live becomes more complex and more difficult to understand. In fact, says our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Eamon Kelly, we are living in a world in which there are multiple contradictory forces exerting themselves. Very dramatic trends, things that certainly we are aware of, that in many cases pull in opposite directions. Our guest here has spent something like the last 15 years working with organizations who are interested in trying to plan for the future and to look ahead. And this morning, in this part of the program, we will be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, Powerful Times, the subtitle, Rising to the Challenge of Our Uncertain World. The book takes a look at seven of these areas, seven cases where there are dramatic and dynamic tensions between trends, in some cases involving things like political power, technology, the relationship of people to the environment, and so forth. And he makes the prediction that it is these trends and these tensions that will reshape human life in the decades to come. The book that we're talking about here, Powerful Times, is published by Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania, where there is the Wharton School of Business. And let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Eamon Kelly is the CEO and the president of Global Business Network. He's also a partner of the Monitor Group. He has done consulting work with dozens of the world's leading corporations in many sectors. He's also worked with some key global and national public agencies and also several major philanthropic foundations. He's the co-author of a couple of other books, including What's Next? Exploring the New Terrain for Business and the Future of the Knowledge Economy. And those books are available if you want to take a look at them. The one that we're talking about here this morning, I'm sure, also is available in the bookstore. And as we talk, questions are welcome. We always welcome input from people who are listening. The only thing we ask is that callers try to be brief as they can so that we can get in as many callers as possible and keep the program moving. But, of course, people who are listening are welcome in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you could hear us. If you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or, in fact, if you're listening on the Internet anywhere else in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Kelly, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. And yourself?
I'm very well, thanks.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time.
It's a pleasure.
As a kind of a general question, my feeling is that probably we could go back to various points in history, and if we could talk to people about their feeling of about the time in which they live, they would tell us some of the kinds of things that people say today. They'd say, the world is becoming more complicated than ever. I'm confused. I'm just not really sure where things are headed. Given that fact, do you truly think that the time in which we are living now is somehow more complicated or more confusing? It is more difficult now to understand the main trends, the currents that run through society, than has been in the past?
Yes, I do. And first of all, I would say I completely agree with your opening analysis there that the world has never been certain. It has never been uncomplicated. It has always been characterized by chance and circumstance. And in fact, in the book, I tell the story of Pandolfo Petrucci, who 500 years ago wrote to Niccolo Machiavelli. Pandolfo Petrucci was the Lord of Siena, and he was being asked why he kept changing his mind, and he wrote back and said, I conduct my business day by day and arrange my affairs hour by hour because the times are more powerful than our brains. And that was 500 years ago, and I think people have always in history felt that the world was complicated and confusing. Mm. But yes, I do actually believe that at this particular moment in human history, we do have a level of complexity and uncertainty that is genuinely unique, simply because there are so many Things have speeded up so much. There are so many actors in the world innovating and creating new things at the same time. There is so much interconnection and interdependence. And, you know, given those factors, I really do believe that we're at a moment of just astronomical complexity and uncertainty. And most importantly, David, you know, from my perspective, a lot of our assumptions are going to be deeply challenged in the next decade or so. And I really do think that in the West in particular, we formed a view of the world that is based on really just the last five centuries, the last 500 years of history. And those assumptions, I believe, are going to be profoundly challenged. And so part of the issue is not just the complexity of the world and the uncertainty, but also the fact that our cognitive processes of understanding what's happening will be deeply challenged as those assumptions are brought into question.
Yeah. There's one more sort of general question. That again, I think it is true. We certainly could go back and find other times in history where, as a result of could be different things, could be environmental trends, could be historical movements, could be social movements, could be technological change. We could point to some point at which there was something happened that was very dramatic that made the time after very different from the time before. And again, having acknowledged the fact that it seems that one of the things that is a reality of our life today is that the pace of these kinds of things is faster. That seems to be more and more things happening faster and faster. Now, again, having said all that, then being able to point to other times when there were significant change, you think that we are at a point now, though, where because of all these things, and we'll talk about some of them, we are at another one of these very significant change points.
Yeah, I do. I think we're at an inflection point in human history. I agree with you. It's far from being the first one. And I think maybe one of the ways of thinking about how this era is different from others is uncertainty at the human level, at the level of the individual, has always been high, and in fact there may well have been times in human history where it's been higher for individuals. You know, my own grandfather found himself having to leave Ireland and go to Scotland, having to leave the farm and go to work in the city, having to change his work maybe 7 or 8 times in his life, and all of that was characterized by profound uncertainty in an era where, you know, we didn't have antibiotics, and you know, people were you know, early deaths were really quite common, etc. So, you know, at the human individual level, uncertainty has always been rife. At the systemic level, I would argue, everything being so deeply interconnected just now and things moving so quickly, as you described there, really does create a different global context of radical change.
Well, I'd like to have you give you a chance to talk a little bit about these areas in which we do find significant trends, dramatic things, and when we talk about them, I'm sure that people won't be particularly surprised at those things.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that in all of these areas, that in each case, it does seem to be that there are pairs of currents, pairs of trends that touch on each issue that pull in opposite directions.
That's
for
great.
Example, your first one has to do with the increasing availability of information.
Yeah.
We have access to more and more information than ever before, and that can be a tremendous advantage in a lot of ways. So that is one trend that's moving in one direction. Paired with that sort of is an opposite trend that says, yes, indeed, we have access to more information and a broader range of information, perhaps, than any people have ever had before. However, the downside of that is that we also have, in that mix of information, there's an awful lot of questionable information, maybe bad information. So it can sometimes be difficult to sort what is correct, what is accurate, what is good, what is solid, from what is not.
That's correct, yeah. And in fact, it's not just that there is a lot of inaccurate information. It's also that the more data you have available, the more perspectives that data can support. So by being selective about the choice of data, we can actually argue almost any perspective in almost any issue. So, you know, I describe this as the dynamic tension of clarity and craziness is the way I characterize it in the book. And, you know, the idea for this, David, might be interesting to share with you, is that I initially three years ago, started working on an earlier version of this book. And I was trying to, my idea was that I was just going to make a list of the biggest uncertainties facing the world, and that's the kind of nature of the work that we do with our corporate and governmental and non-profit clients, is help them frame the most important uncertainties in the world that will impact them going forward, and then, you know, deeply understand them. And as I looked at them, and I spent a lot of time working with colleagues and a network of advisors and experts in various fields, and what started to occur to me was that I was actually headed in the wrong direction, that it wasn't about a list of uncertainties, that it would either be this or it would be that. What I was actually seeing was that the uncertainties were somewhat standing in tension with one another. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I had to change my way of thinking from what I describe as either or, it will either go this way or it will go that way, towards a kind of both and perspective. And so the big theme of the book is we have to, you know, create a better ability to think in both and terms and understand the interrelationships between these apparently contradictory forces. Mm. And I actually quote Niels Bohr, the Danish physicist, who I think really sums this whole this notion up perfectly when he said, "The opposite of a correct statement is a false statement, but the opposite of a profound truth is very often another profound truth." And I think that's actually true in the world today as well.
Right. I think that you really, you do a nice job of summarizing what are significant trends, and that any one of these, one could talk for a very long time about just one of those things.
Yeah.
But I think there you've just said something what now strikes me as really being very important, is that there are these, you've paired these trends that around certain issues that pull in different directions, and
yeah,
that sometimes we think about, or maybe people who are intensely partisan, if that's an appropriate word to use, and some of these things, think about in terms of winning or losing, that is somehow one or the other side is going to win. And it,
yeah,
it seems that in fact, it is more the case that you could say with a fair amount of certainty that neither side is going to win, that somehow we should not expect there to be a resolution in favor of one or the other of the poles, but that in fact the tug of what we're going to see is the continuing tug of war.
Exactly. Yes. No. That's quite correct. And that was the that was the way I started to think about it when I moved from an either-or series of uncertainties to a both-and series of dynamic tensions, as I describe them. And, you know, would you like me to comment on the clarity and craziness one? And
sure.
Use that as an
sure.
example of
mm-hmm.
what I see happening there. It does seem to me that if you look at the world today, we have an undesigned and, you know, in some ways kind of unintentional new reality of an incredibly see-through, transparent world. I mean, think about the data that's being assembled everywhere, our ability to scrutinize it, its communication and spread through the internet. Think about all the sensing devices that exist in the world today. Think about all the surveillance cameras. Think about the satellites. We've created a world in which there is an incredible kind of clarity and ability to see so much that's happening. And, you know, one of the nice examples of that, I think, is in Japan several years ago, what was then the largest supercomputer, the most powerful supercomputer in the world, it's now been overtaken by two others, but the largest one at that time, that they called the Earth Simulator, and it has been trying to simulate the Earth's climate and drawing upon data and sensors that are in the air, that are in the oceans, globally, satellite surveillance, etc., and really trying to better model and understand the Earth's climate, which is, of course, a hugely important topic just now. And this is an amazing upgrade in terms of our ability and our knowledge and our understanding of the Earth's climate on anything that would ever have been possible, you know, any time in history. And elsewhere, you know, I think, you know, all of your listeners will have their own examples, but, you know, for me, you have Google that's enabling research in incredibly powerful ways. You have scorecard.org, which is a website that you can put in your zip code, and it will tell you which companies in your area are polluting and what ways and what should be done about it. You know, you have the ePinions network, for example, that allows consumers to inform each other about products. You have data mining, you know, I think the most spectacular version of data mining, you know, better understanding customers, is actually Walmart, who, you know, use this incredibly effectively and discover, you know, odd things like through their data mining, they discovered that before a hurricane, when people know that a hurricane is coming, they change their consumption patterns. They stock in particular things, including, oddly enough, strawberry Pop-Tarts, which, you know, the demand for strawberry Pop-Tarts increases eightfold right ahead of a hurricane. And, you know, knowing that, you know, obviously Walmart sent trucks of Pop-Tarts into areas. You have Witness, which is another website that gives video technology to empower human rights activists around the world. So you've got so many ways in which technology and sensors and surveillance are coming together to create this incredible transparency and clarity, which is, you know, extremely empowering and positive. Now, there are actually going to be, you know, clearly some important privacy trade-offs there, which I know will be of concern to many people. And, you know, an anecdote that illustrates that quite well is that in London, a couple of years ago, they introduced a congestion tax, which is a roughly a $10 a day tax to bring your car into central London. And they put cameras all around all the streets that as you enter central London to, you know, check people's license plates and to see if there's any license plates coming in that didn't actually, you know, have a permit for entering the city on that day. And very quickly it was discovered that, in fact, this was now these cameras were actually, you know, being used to scrutinize not just the license plates but also the drivers and to see if there were, you know, any suspected terrorists or whatever coming into central London. And this created a huge kind of wave of, you know, resistance and concern about the misuse of this kind of technology. But that's only the start of the other side of clarity, which, you know, I would argue is craziness, which is that the more data you have, it enables more versions of reality. And as, you know, as people try to make sense of the world, they are capable of, you know, coming up with very kind of particular views, and then there's lots and lots of evidence to support any particular perspective that anybody wishes to take. And I think the other dimension to that is that you have you know, a rash of conspiracy theories emerging today in the world. Somebody once said that the web is like a petri dish for conspiracy theories, and some of these are very sophisticated. You know, I remember one day while I was researching for this book, I decided to spend a day looking at conspiracy theories relating to, you know, the tragic events of 9/11. And I was tremendously struck by the range of, you know, theories that are out there and how well documented they are. I mean, at the end of the day, I was finding myself having to convince remind myself that I was doing research into conspiracy theories that I knew to be false, because they have, you know, multimedia, they have audio and visual backup and evidence for all of these, you know, quite bizarre theories. And I think we're seeing more and more emergence of conspiracy theories about almost everything. You know, your listeners may recall that when the tsunami struck the Indian Ocean last year, there was a lot of concern about, you know, whether this had actually been triggered by, you know, the U.S. military testing weapons. And there was questions being asked even on the BBC's website. British Broadcasting Corporation's website was asking viewers for their views on whether there was any, you know, anything sinister about the fact that the island of Diego Garcia, which has got a U.S. military base on it, had not been affected by the tsunami. Bizarre and kind of quite crazy conspiracy theories that are spreading. And then you also have, of course, phishing and ID theft and all the other opportunities for people to masquerade as other people. And then, of course, you have governments and corporations, you know, deliberately kind of creating campaigns of misinformation that, might or might not get discovered. But what you're seeing is that these technologies can also be used to misinform and to confuse.
Let me introduce again, just for anybody who might have tuned in, our guest for this hour, Eamon Kelly. He is the CEO and president of Global Business Network. He's also a partner of the Monitor Group, and he has done consulting work for many big corporations, also key global and national public agencies, and also several philanthropic foundations. And the idea all is to do this exercise that really in a way led to this book, that is to think about what's going on in the world and to think about major trends and to look ahead and to anticipate how those trends may play out and what it will mean for how it is that we live. And if you're interested in reading some of his ideas, you can look for the book, Powerful Times, Rising to the Challenge of Our Uncertain World. It's published by Wharton School Publishing. And questions are welcome too, 333-9455, toll free 800. 1-800-222-9455. Here now, you've given a little bit of an example of the first of this set of dynamic tensions that you talk about in the book. And there are a number of others, for example, that is the conflict and the tensions between a secular worldview and a sacred one. There is one that involves technology, which looks at the tensions involving the tension between the rapid pace of technological growth and, on the other hand, concerns about the impact of technology. Do we want it or do we not? How will it change our lives? There are things that have to do with environment. There are things that have to do with the changing nature of power. There is a tension between global prosperity and global decline. So there are these number of things. And one of the things that it occurs to me is it invites, and now, you know, there's this great preoccupation with values. Well, it does indeed invite questions and gives one the opportunity to look at each one of these areas and ask a values question in the large sense. That is, that question being, well, what is important to me? And this could be a structure for a person sitting down and thinking, well, you know, in a number of ways, what really is important to me? I think that we have this idea that there are so many different ways of looking at this that the idea of some kind of emerging consensus would be impossible. And I wonder whether you, in fact, that you think that is true, or that if we look at these kinds of things as a structure to talk about individuals and their values, whether there actually would be more agreement than we might think.
Yeah, it's a great question. One of the more demoralizing experiences that I had several years ago, that again was actually part of my motivation in writing this book, was on a business trip to Manhattan. I went, I'm sure as many of your listeners love to do, when you have a spare hour, go and visit a bookstore and browse. And I was browsing in the current affairs section and looking at this array of books that had come out, this would be 2.5 years ago or so, that had come out recently around the domestic political situation in the United Kingdom, in the United States. And I was dismayed as I kind of flicked through them to discover that these books were all basically arguing from one perspective or another that all liberals were traitors and all conservatives were liars. Mm-hmm. And the polarization of the content of these books really quite dismayed me, because my view of the world just now is that we face very, very major challenges in terms of the climate, in terms of infectious diseases, in terms of terrorism, etc., all of which require truly global thinking, and all of which require both and holistic thinking. And here is the arguably the most powerful nation in the history of the world, where its domestic political dialogue, you know, was frankly seems to me to be at a level that is almost childish in its simplicity. And so I think the question of, you know, can we find the shared values embedded in some of the ideas that I share in this book is a tremendously important one, because I think staying in a kind of name-calling, argumentative debate, either or, right and wrong, black and white mentality is too simplistic for the challenges that we're facing just now in the world. And I actually am very confident that in the years ahead we will see much more of a global perspective, a much more holistic perspective emerging, and a larger sense of human identity, because frankly, I think some of the challenges in, you know, the next 20 to 30 years, particularly some of the challenges related perhaps to climate change, really will force us to acknowledge that, we are one species, we are living on a shared planet, and, you know, part of the journey of human history has been towards a larger sense of identity, from the self and the family and the clan and the tribe to the nation to the region, and I think ultimately to the species.
I think that's interesting, because it certainly occurs to me that if you're looking for a kind of an overarching idea, if you look at all of the areas that you look at and say, what is a major implication? To me, I think interconnectedness, increasing interconnectedness, is the major implication. And as you say, that we do, as a world on a global scale, we do feature a number of challenges that will require that kind of thinking. Now, at the same time, that it seems kind of distressing that if you look at the story of the post-Cold War world, it seems that we have seen an awful lot of thinking going in the absolute opposite direction. that is increasing, in many cases, increasing insularity, increasing nationalism, things that people, in a sense, pulling in and not looking at the world in that other sort of way. I wonder whether you, in fact, you see that, but also whether you have seen it maybe recently some indication that that might have begun to change.
Yeah, I believe, well, first of all, I think you're correct that, you know, again, I think both of these dynamics are in play at the moment. I think there is definitely, I think, an emergence globally of a sense of being in this altogether. I just returned, for example, yesterday I just returned from a trip to Japan, and I had exactly these kind of conversations in Japan, and one of the topics that people were really very, very keen to explore with me was how can Japan and China put aside some of their historical differences and truly become, you know, partners for, you know, a greater Asia, and frankly, you know, a better, more prosperous, more equitable world. And I was very struck at the nature of the conversations I was having, that people genuinely seemed to want to find ways of getting integrated rather than separated, and being more connected rather than disconnected. And I think that's the evidence of a growing awareness of the profound interdependence. You used the word interconnected, which I agree with. I think there's also a huge awareness of interdependence in the world. And simple things like, well, maybe not so simple, but important things that people are paying attention to just now, I think will continue to develop this awareness that you can't think about most of the problems that exist at the moment in the world can't really be solved at the level of any individual nation. A good example of that is there's been a lot of talk lately, as you know, about the prospect of an avian flu pandemic. Well, one of the things that if that ever happens, and it's, you know, far from certain it will, but it easily could. And one of the things that we'll learn in the course of that is that this, we can't think about healthcare at a national level. You can't think about protecting ourselves at a national level. Things like a global an avian flu pandemic will you know, inform us that we have to think globally about the health system, because it's really about much better surveillance in Asia, where such viruses develop, much better surveillance there, and prioritization of vaccines around the areas where human cases are first identified is by far the most effective way of preventing such a thing, as opposed to trying to, in a great rush, develop vaccines for 300 million Americans, which is, you know, almost certainly not going to be possible. So by far the most effective thing we could be doing to protect Americans from an avian flu pandemic is actually investing in a global avian flu surveillance system, which would not be, you know, taking place primarily within the United States. And I think that's the kind of example that we're going to become increasingly aware of in the decades ahead, that will force us into a much larger sense of, you know, a global sense of we, and a much more kind of interconnected sense of what we must do together in order to prosper.
I'm interested in drawing on some of your experience with doing consulting with various kinds of organizations that you have done, and just drawing on another one of these dynamic pairs that are in tension, looking at the fact that as you look at economies, that increasingly we have to make stuff. We have to have cars, we have to have highways, we have to have airplanes, we have to have bridges, we have to have that kind of stuff. But also the economies are increasingly dependent upon services, information, not the kind of things that you can hold in your hand. Yeah. So given that we still have still need both of those things, supposing that I said to you, well, we're going to convene a meeting and we're going to bring in, we'll bring in the guys who run General Motors and we'll bring in the guys who run Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And so here we have the two different sorts of poles represented, and we'll sit him down here and we'll bring you in and we'll introduce you and say, now here's a guy who is interested in all these long-term trends and done a lot of consulting with businesses. So here you have people who represent the two, sort of the old, more of the old kind of industry and the new kind of industry. If then we said, tell us GM guys and tell us Microsoft guys, what are the lessons that you think that we might draw from this book and thinking about these trends as we think about what the future of our business is and how we're going to stay in business and what people are going to want and how we go about supplying that?
Well, I wouldn't presume to speak for either of those two, you know, great organizations and corporations. But I would say that the my experience of consulting to the corporate sector is that the level of awareness within corporations of the kind of global connectivity of the world today and the need to think in a truly global perspective is actually probably more sophisticated and more developed in the corporate sector than anywhere else. I think our corporations today are really driving and setting the agenda for how the world is shaping up and are truly thinking about global connectivity and interdependence. And I'm finding a couple of things that are, you know, in some ways I think really quite encouraging in that the I think that whereas maybe 10, 15 years ago, concern for the environment, for example, in the corporate sector was something that people would talk about over coffee breaks and would, you know, maybe pay lip service to in the course of a kind of a, you know, truly strategic workshop. Whereas now those kind of issues really are quite central to the thinking of a lot of corporate executives. I think also, you know, questions about, you know, social sustainability, authenticity, character, trust, those issues seem to me to have become much more important and prevalent in the corporate world than they were 10 or 15 years ago. I also find myself in a lot more conversations now than I used to about really understanding the requirements of other stakeholders, really a willingness to participate more fully in multi-stakeholder conversations and dialogues, conversations about the moral purpose of the corporation. And I think that there is a you know, for me there's a sense that corporations are truly changing, that there is a, you know, a willingness to take responsibility for the, you know, the sustainability of the world, and, you know, I think some kind of conflict about how we balance the pursuit of growth and prosperity, which is clearly, you know, tremendously important, with the other needs that you know, that exist in the world that humans have for, you know, social justice, environmental sustainability, etc. So I find my work with the corporate sector to actually be deeply encouraging in terms of the seriousness with which most corporations are you know, looking to the future.
Hmm. Would we, if we could do this same sort of exercise, and instead of having people who were corporate managers, we got people who were government officials and sort of did the same sort of exercise, would that in a sense be the same kind of conversation?
My experience is that those conversations tend to be, first of all, I would say that, you know, the quality of people and the kind of thoughtfulness and responsibility of people, I think, is, you know, just as high in the government sector. What I do find different in the government sector is that there tends to be probably a little more of a local or national focus, which is natural, but I do think that the corporations are typically thinking more in a truly global perspective, and less kind of protective of you know, a national agenda of priorities and interests.
We have about 20, moving into about our last 20 minutes. And again, let me just mention that if people who are interested in calling in with questions, comments, we'd be certainly happy to hear from you here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We're talking with Eamon Kelly, CEO of Global Business Network. It's a futures network and a consulting agency. Has done work for business, for government, for philanthropic groups, and he is the author of the book Powerful Times: Rising to the Challenge of Our Uncertain World. It's published by Wharton Business Publishing, well, Wharton School Publishing. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, given the fact that, again, as we have explained, what you've done is you've tried to look at a number of areas and look at what is going on in these areas. And again, we've talked about things like information. We've talked a little bit about technology. We've talked about economic issues. There are a number of them. And in each one of these, you've said within there, we see tension going on and forces that seem to be pulling in different directions, in opposite directions, and acknowledging the fact that that kind of dynamic tension we should expect to continue, and that it's not really a matter of one side or the other is we expect is going to dominate. It's more like that it's going to be a tug of war that's just going to keep on going. So, and having said that, though, you do then go on to think a little bit about a bigger sort of long-term kind of global trend, like what might be likely to happen as we look at these things and we watch them continue to play out and the wrestling continue. I mean, you have laid out some possible scenarios for the long term, for the future. What do you see as possibilities?
Yeah. I've laid out three scenarios, and I think the future will be some kind of messy combination of all of them, probably. But with one of them probably being more in the forefront than the others. And by scenarios, what I mean is three different stories about what the future might look like and what forces will most particularly be in play. The scenarios are based on a couple of things that I think are pretty uncertain at the moment, and so the first major uncertainty that I see is whether the future will really continue to have a very strong United States of America influence in shaping the world, or whether that influence will decline somewhat from what it's been over the last 100 years or so. And then the second thing that I think is uncertain at the moment is whether our kind of top-down, more hierarchical, more centralized organizational forums and sources of innovation, etc., continue to prevail, or whether we really are at a point where, with connective technologies and the ability of citizens to organize in a very different kind of ways, whether we might actually see a more bottom-up driven world of decentralized networks of citizens, etc., really kind of shaping the global agenda much more forcefully. And if you take if we assume that the top down continues to hold, then I think that the two scenarios that I see there are one in which the top down holds and the United States remains a deeply kind of powerful and shaping influence in the world, and I call that the New American Century, and it's really I would argue it's probably the world that the U.S. administration just now is hoping to forge. It's a world in which American values of democracy and the American form of capitalism, etc., American kind of concepts of freedom and individual autonomy, etc., really kind of prevail, and that the other countries that are emerging to their full power at the moment, such as China and India and later on perhaps Brazil, will kind of play by the rules that are currently in play just now around the kind of global economic structures, and China will increasingly kind of open up its political processes and make them more transparent and ultimately more democratic, etc. And that's a world that is, I think, quite credible and quite plausible, but is not guaranteed by any manner of means, because there is definitely evidence of growing concern about and pushback against U.S. dominance in the world and U.S.'s kind of setting of the agenda in the world. And I can equally imagine another scenario in which the top-down kind of format holds, but we see the very powerful emergence of other players helping to set the agenda. I call that scenario patchwork powers, and it's a world in which kind of geopolitical and economic power and influence are being distributed and shared much more equally, where international institutions become more important, where the U.S.'s role becomes somewhat more balanced with the fact that the United States is less than 5% of the world's population, and while I can't imagine the United States having only 5% of the influence in the world, I can imagine it declining in its influence from where it is just now, and I can imagine in patchwork powers we would see China, in particular, really emerging as a much more of a shaper in world affairs. And it's interesting to note that, China just now is reaching out to other developing parts of the world. China is creating a lot of linkages with Africa. It's creating a lot of linkages with Latin America. And the easy default assumption that people are making just now is that that's really about trying to secure access to natural resources and energy. But I would argue that, in fact, China is playing a rather more sophisticated long-term game than that. China's understanding that Africa and Latin America are parts of the world that, like China, are very likely to kind of become more powerful players in the future, and they want to have influential relationships with them. And so I can imagine that, you know, China becomes more influential, the European Union perhaps kind of bridges between Asia and the United States and also kind of, you know, finds its voice perhaps more powerfully. And the third scenario is the one in which really it's less about the top-down and it's more about the bottom-up. It's a world of more distributed power. It's much more decentralized. The kind of established traditional models of, you know, power and leadership and even organizations start to kind of fade a little bit. And, you know, entrepreneurs and open source networks are proving, you know, very flexible and nimble. And there's a lot more kind of bottom-up experimentation for finding, you know, locally based solutions to sustainability and environmental challenges, etc. And there's a lot of emergence of a kind of, you know, global sense of citizenry that is, I think, beginning to happen on the internet at the moment in many ways. And so, you know, you can imagine a different world of, you know, people following their passions and their powers in a much more bottom-up and distributed way. And that really the idea of it being, you know, America that sets the agenda or China that sets the agenda or whatever, it becomes less central because, you know, things are more locally organized and more kind of distributed in terms of the, you know, where influence lies.
So it sounds as if, though, no matter what happens, which of these scenarios we see that either of the last two, at least, that we're looking at a decline in American dominance, and that it seems like that we're leaning in the direction of moving toward a time when the United States will not be the sole superpower. It's possible that it might manage to hold on to its military dominance because that's I think that's not probably something that, say, people in India or Brazil are going to think all that much about. The only other of these four countries we've talked about that could match the United States in those terms probably would be China. But that if we in all those three places particularly, and I think it's interesting that I've heard a lot of other people make that same list and talk about, you know, we have every reason to expect 20, 30 years, several decades in the future that those three are going to emerge at least as very significant economic powers to rival the economic power of the United States. So it looks to me like we're sort of leaning in the direction of a much more multipolar world than we have now, whether it's the patchwork powers or whether it's the more bottom up world. Do you think that there do you feel like leaning one way or another on that kind of question?
Well, it's interesting. I've actually done surveys of people's opinions and explained the three scenarios and asked them which one they think is, you know, most likely and which one's unfolding. And I've discovered that the mood on that actually swings depending on, you know, how things have been going in Iraq or you know, the latest polls on you know, U.S. popularity, etc. So there's a lot of volatility in how people feel about this. My own view is that the new American century scenario, the one in which, you know, U.S. influence continues to prevail, I think is a credible scenario, but it's different from the U.S. influence in the world today, which is that the U.S. is, you know, by far the largest consumer of goods. It's, 40% of the world's R&D investment is taking place in the United States. Most innovations in technology and in new products, et cetera, is coming out of the United States of America. That, to my mind, simply cannot prevail. That is not going to last. We are going to see innovation and economic strength and technological development disperse much more rapidly and much more fully around the world. I think what the United States can continue to have, but it's not guaranteed, is that the United States value system, you talked earlier about values, I think it's possible the United States value system could actually spread, and that the kind of the rules of economic engagement could actually continue to be the rules that are the Western and, you know, United States favorable rules. But I think you're right that So the U.S. influence, I think, could continue to be high. The U.S.'s dominance in the world, I think, will inevitably decline in the course of this century. You mentioned the military dimension. Perhaps my biggest fear at the moment is my fear of military conflict between the United States and China, which I personally believe is profoundly unnecessary, but I think also is a distinct threat. China has a standing army of 3 million people, which is a fairly substantial army. It does not have anything like the military technology that the United States has, and that will continue to be true for a decade or so. But I do think that China will become a formidable presence in the world, not just economically, but also militarily. And I truly hope that we are able to find ways of enabling that to happen without, and accepting that happening without resorting to kind of violence and confrontation, which I think would be catastrophic for us all.
Let's talk with a caller here, someone here where we are, here in Champaign-Urbana, in line one. Hello.
Hi. Some say there was a early age of globalism up till 1914, a lot of trade, and it didn't reach the same level until about 1970. But comment on, Keynes, who criticized Churchill for going back on a precious metal standard, and it said that now the West is in debt to the East, so that might mitigate any potential conflict. But it's also said that if the East stops buying Western debt, then there'll be a lot of problems, like higher interest rates.
Yeah. Well, you want to comment on any of that?
Yeah, well, your caller is exactly right that the world economy was extremely globalized in the 19th century, right up until the outbreak of World War One, and he's quite right that it wasn't until the early 1970s that we achieved the same level of global economic integration. I think what's different this time around is that the economic globalization of the 19th century was actually much more around empire than it was around free trade. And I think the other thing we need to recall is that the economy of the 19th century was puny in comparison with the economy of the world just now. And one fact that I think is well worth keeping in mind is that in the 20th century, the world produced more economic output in that single 100 years than it achieved in the previous 3 million years of human history. So we have, we did something truly remarkable in the 20th century, which was this, I call it the century of prosperity. But there were definitely consequences of that, environmental consequences. You don't produce more economic output in 100 years than you've done in the previous 3 million without there being environmental consequences. And also, the prosperity of the 20th century was very, very unevenly distributed. The polarization between countries and even within countries was quite extreme and accelerating through the course of the 20th century. Those are challenges that I think are now being addressed. On the point of the East-West issue, yeah, I mean, there is no doubt just now that if China, the central banks in China, were to withdraw their dollar holdings and their support, really, of the U.S. economy, the consequences would be quite extreme. And I think there is a – this is what I mean when I talk about interdependence. We actually we need to understand that while China may well be seen increasingly as a competitive threat, China is also actually a very, very important part of the global economic system and a very important kind of piece of supporting U.S. prosperity in the future, too.
Just we have a couple of minutes left, and perhaps as a final question. We've talked a little bit about this being your feeling that we're at a very significant point of change, and
yeah,
we have talked a little bit about possible scenarios, the way things might go. It is likely that if we're lucky, some of us will live to see this, at least we'll live another 10 or 20 years, and certainly our children will live into this era.
Yeah.
What can one say for an individual if you're planning on living through this? What does that mean? And what does it mean for us and how we think about the future and perhaps all sorts of things, how we live, what kind of education we have, what we think about in terms of employment? I mean, what does it really mean for individuals, do you think?
Yeah, I think what it means for individuals is that we actually have to be prepared for, I think, a bit of a roller coaster in the years ahead. I think that one thing we haven't talked much about is the challenge of climate change, which I think is probably, certainly in the lifespan of my children, is probably a reality. And just thinking about what does it take to be prepared for a world in which the climate is, you know, profoundly different from the existing climate, and sea levels change, and the sea-land balance moves, and perhaps if the Gulf Stream fails, which is, you know, again a distinct possibility, Northern Europe actually, you know, suddenly has a, you know, not a warming but a, you know, significant colding phenomenon. Being prepared for those kind of changes is, I think, something that, you know, all human beings have to address and acknowledge, and I think that the, you know, we are definitely going to see, regardless of the degree of climate change we witness, we're going to see nature kind of batting last. We're going to see events in nature, whether they're infectious diseases or you know, weather challenges or earthquakes or whatever. We're all going to be living through those things, and the degree of preparedness that we can bring to that is much higher than we typically realize. There are many things that we can do just now, like creating digital records of our medical records, for example, so that if we, you know, happen to find ourselves in the midst of an avian flu pandemic and our local hospital can't see us but somewhere else can, we'd be able to take our records with us. Those are the small things that we should be able to do, really just paying attention to the prospect that, you know, the world as we've known it may be changing in reasonably profound ways, and that we are not victims of that. We are a remarkably ingenious and curious and capable and inventive species. I personally believe that we will indeed, you know, prevail through these powerful times, but I do think that it requires us to kind of open up and open up ourselves to the prospects of really quite radical change and things being quite different from what we've experienced in the past.
There, we must stop because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Eamon Kelly, is CEO and President of Global Business Network and a partner of the Monitor Group. The book, if you would like to read it, is Powerful Times, Rising to the Challenge of Our Uncertain World, published by Wharton School Publishing. And Mr. Kelly, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.
This show, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more news and features and weather and other things coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, writer Candace Millard will be our guest. She is the author of The River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey. The book tells the story of Roosevelt's descent and his mapping of a tributary of the Amazon. That's what we'll talk about this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. 1 minute before noon Central Time, let's take a look at the markets. First, we're going to make that stop in Kansas City. Kansas March wheat trading at 366.5 unchanged. Now to Chicago, the Chicago Board.